Amen. Well, you guys can take a seat. My name is Mike. I'm one of the pastors at Revision. I'm excited to be here today. How about you? All right. It's great to see you guys. It's great to be with all of you who are online. Thanks for being here from wherever you are. So in October of 1918, World War I was reaching some of its most decisive moments, and victory and loss hung in the balance. Nine companies from the American 77th Infantry Division advanced in the Argonne Forest in northern France, believing that they were supported on their flanks by French forces to the left and the American 92nd Infantry Division to their right. They made quick and easy progress, only to discover too late that the forces on their flanks had stalled and they were alone, cut off, and completely surrounded by the enemy. And after German reinforcements arrived, none of the Allied troops could get to them or help. They became known as the Lost Battalion. And they were under heavy mortar and machine gun fire, facing attacks from every side. And after a few days, they'd suffered heavy casualties. They were running out of ammunition, food, and drinkable water. And the entire battalion had it rough, but nobody had it worse than the 308th Regiment, which was cut off even from the rest of the troops, and the victim of friendly fire after some wrong coordinates got delivered. American artillery shells began to rain down on the ravine where they were dug in. And the only method of communication they had available to them at this point was carrier pigeons, and the 308th was down to their last pigeon. And so their commander, Charles Wellesley, scrawled out a note. "We are along the road, parallel, 276.4. Our artillery is dropping a barrage right on us. For heaven's sake, stop it." And he sent the pigeon on its way. And less than 3 seconds later, as the bird was ascending, Wellesley and his men watched as a stray bullet hit that pigeon straight in the head. You ever felt hopeless? I mean, the situation of the Lost Battalion kind of puts our hopelessness into perspective, but I think every single one of us in this room, certainly over the course of the last 10 months, has felt some hopelessness. We all know what it is to feel like our situation is almost impossible to overcome in the middle of this pandemic that's raging across the globe that's beyond our control. And whether it's because of Corona or in addition to Corona or some sort of mix of the two, I know that there are a lot of us sitting here this morning, a lot of us tuned in online right now who are struggling. Maybe you're struggling with a relationship that feels like it's blowing up, or one that blew up a long time ago and you're still not sure how to move forward. Maybe you're struggling financially and you're not sure what you're going to do when there's too much month left at the end of the money. Maybe you're struggling with a kid who seems to be hitting the self-destruct button in the middle of all this. Maybe work feels like it's sucking the life out of you every single day, or you're fighting depression, addiction, or something else. But whatever it is, I think every human on the planet knows what it is to feel like the last reservoirs of hope are drying up inside of our souls. And the question is, what do we do with that? What do we do when it feels like we're stranded in the wilderness of life and we've come to the end of ourselves? What do we do when it feels like our situation is so hopeless that this has to be the final chapter of our story because there is no way forward? Well, this morning we're in week two of a series called Winning in the Wilderness, where we've been talking about how we can thrive in the middle of life's difficult seasons by digging in to the story of Daniel. And we're going to pick up his story today in a moment where he is facing this exact situation. He's been tasked with doing the impossible or facing the end of his story. So if you have a Bible or a Bible with you, you can crack it open to the book of Daniel chapter 2. If you don't have a Bible handy, you can follow along in the Revision app or on the screen. If you need a Bible, please take one from the Next Steps table before you go. They're free. If you're watching online, you can let us know on your digital connection card and we will mail you one. But before we dive into the story, I want to recap last week real quick. For those of you who might not have been here, we'll get you caught up. Daniel was a Jew. He'd grown up and spent his entire life in Jerusalem until the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar came and laid siege to the city. He attacked it, and eventually he conquered Jerusalem, and he laid waste to the entire city. I mean, he burnt it to the ground, and he took the best and the brightest people he could find and carried them off to exile in Babylon. And Daniel, along with some of his best friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, were among the exiles. And those four guys got enrolled in this training program where the Babylonians attempted to strip them of their heritage, their identity, and their faith so that they would completely assimilate to the culture around them and then become Babylonian public servants. But interestingly enough, even though as young men, they got tossed into this incredibly frightening, difficult, seemingly impossible situation, the four of them were able to maintain their faith, their integrity, and their hope because they believed that God is bigger than Babylon. God is bigger than Babylon. As a matter of fact, one of the very first things Daniel tells us in his book is that this whole thing happened because God allowed it to happen. He wants us to know that his unfortunate situation wasn't the result of Nebuchadnezzar having like this big bad army that nobody could stop. It was the result of God delivering Judah into the hands of the Babylonians, which kind of seems a little bit crazy, doesn't it? Like, I read that and I can't help but wonder, why would God do that? And I know that God told his people repeatedly, if you turn your backs on me and you start walking down these like destructive paths toward idolatry and death, I'm going to let your nation be conquered if I believe that's the only way to turn you back toward life. But God didn't just let the nation be conquered and the people be carried off into exile. He let the entire city burn, including the temple, his temple, where he had promised that he would be present in the world. And not only did the temple get destroyed, Nebuchadnezzar walked into that temple and he took all of the sacred holy objects and all of the gold and he carried them off and he stuck them in the temple of his god, Marduk, in Babylon. And he basically said to the exiles, hey, look at all those things that used to matter to you. They don't matter anymore. Your God doesn't matter anymore. I took his temple and I took his stuff. He does not care. He is not coming. He's done. He's over. He's silent. And the future that you thought you had, it belongs to me now. You're living into the future that I shape. My empire will be the thing that you worship. And what we got to understand is that when Nebuchadnezzar took all the holy items from the temple in Jerusalem and stuck them into his own place of worship, he believed that he was wiping that God off the map forever. That's where we're at. That's the situation in Daniel 2. And so we're going to pick up the story in verse 1. It's kind of a long story. I'm going to read a big chunk of it, and then we'll talk about it. It says, in the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled, and he could not sleep. So the king summoned the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed. When they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, I have had a dream that troubles me, and I want to know what it means. Then the astrologers answered the king, may the king live forever. It's always good to suck up to the king, right? And they said, tell your servants the dream and we will interpret it. The king replied to the astrologers, this is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me what my dream was and then interpret it, I will have you cut into pieces and your houses turned into piles of rubble. But if you tell me the dream and explain it, you'll receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. So tell me the dream and then interpret it for me. And once more they replied, let the king tell his servants the dream and we will interpret it. And the king answered, I'm certain you're just trying to gain time. You're buying time here because you realize this is what I've firmly decided. If you do not tell me the dream, there is one penalty for you. You've conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things, hoping the situation will change. So then tell me the dream and I'll know you can interpret it for me. The astrologers answered the king, there's no one on earth who can do what the king asks. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among humans. And this made the king so angry and furious that he ordered the execution of all the wise men in Babylon. Okay, so Nebuchadnezzar's had this nightmare. And it's haunting him. It's keeping him up at night. And the text here kind of reveals that this might have been a recurring dream. Like every time he's falling asleep at night, he keeps waking up in a cold sweat to this. You ever been there? You keep falling off the same cliff every time you fall asleep? So he's frightened. And he calls in all of his astrologers and all of his magicians and all of his enchanters and all of his wise men. And these are the exact guys that we read about in Luke chapter 2. They're the magi from the east who came to worship Jesus when they saw his star rise. They're basically these pagan wizards who read the stars and the signs and the spirits and read a whole bunch of religious mythology and other textbooks in order to advise the king. To be fair, when we hear the word pagan wizards or the phrase pagan wizards, we think like people who dress up in funny costumes and make stuff up. And there was a lot of that going on. But also, these guys were brilliant. They were the best, smartest, most educated humans in the world at this time. I mean, they were so good that in the year 500 BC, the Babylonian astrologer Nammurabi calculated the length of a year, like one of Earth's rotations around the sun, at 365 days, 14 hours, and some minutes. He was 26 and a half minutes off. With the technology that he had then, these guys were amazing. I mean, they were real good, but as good as they were, they weren't good enough to tell a king what he had dreamed last night. Like, they could take the data from his dream and input it into their books and their systems and kind of make up some mostly baloney answer about what it all meant. But the problem was Nebuchadnezzar wasn't an idiot either. He was one of the most brilliant rulers the ancient world ever saw, and he realized that these guys were mostly feeding him stuff that they just made up. And he knew that they'd tell it to him with a straight face, like, oh, this is definitely the answer, man. And he's like, okay, time out. You guys have been telling me a lot of stuff for a really long time, but if you're as in touch with the signs and the stars and the spirits as you say you are, you should be able to tell me what I dreamed also. So I want you to tell me what the dream was, and then I'm actually going to believe that you can interpret it. And if you can't tell me what the dream was, I'm going to feel like you've been lying to me for a really long time and making a pretty good salary to do it, and I'm going to be so ticked off about that. I'm going to cut you up into little pieces. I'm going to smash your houses into rubble and turn them into, like, well, the translation we just read says piles of rubble. But that's kind of like the sanitized, Christianized version of it for prim, proper Christian people. Because sometimes the translator's like, oh, ladies in church will not want to hear the actual word. Because the actual word Nebuchadnezzar says here is Nivali. I'm going to turn your houses into the place where everyone dumps the poop. The people poop, the animal poop, poop piles. He's not kidding around. He says, tell me what I dreamed, or this is what you're facing. Made you guys a picture. This is what they call a sermon illustration. I don't know if you can tell, but I made that myself because I want you to be able to visualize. This is what's going down. These wise men are told, you got to guess what I dreamed last night or this. And that's a lot, you guys. That's a lot to deal with. And so they look at him and they're like, we can't do that. That's not a thing. Nobody asks. That's not our job, man. What do you, like, kings don't ask that of wise. We can't guess what you dreamed. No one can, only a god could do that. And I love it because they don't even realize what they're doing, and Nebuchadnezzar doesn't either, but subtly and unintentionally, they're pointing the king to the thing he actually needs. Man, only a god can help you. He says, I don't care. I'm going to cut you to pieces, figure it out. And so we can't do it. And with their own words, they're undercutting their own jobs. They're saying, look, we're not as magic as we've let on. We're false prophets, man. Everything we're doing is just natural and it's human. And you're asking for something that's supernatural. And we believe that maybe there's some God that exists out there in the universe that could answer your question. But what God? They don't live among us or talk to us. And Nebuchadnezzar hears that, and basically he decides his suspicions are confirmed. He decides he's killing every last one of them. Except the problem for Daniel is that him and Mishael and Azariah and Hananiah, they're on that list. They were really smart kids, so that's what they got trained to do. And this is what happens next. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death. And men were sent to look for Daniel and his friends to put them to death. When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. He asked the king's officer, why did the king issue such a harsh decree? Arioch then explained the matter to Daniel. At this, Daniel went in to the king and asked for time so that he might interpret the dream for him. I love this part so much. Arioch shows up, and he's like, hey, man. And Daniel's like, Arioch, what's up, bro? He's like, oh, I'm going to cut you to pieces, turn your house into a poop pile. King's orders. And Daniel's going, wait, what? No one told me about this. What is happening? Can we just press pause real quick? And he finds out what's happening, and he goes in to see Nebuchadnezzar, and he's like, hey, Nebuchadnezzar, buddy, I heard you're killing everybody because they told you only a god can answer your question. Turns out I know him. So why don't you give me a minute to talk to him, and I'll come tell you the answer. And the king is so stunned and taken aback that Daniel says he can talk to God, that he gives him a day. And this is what happens next. Again, it's a huge, long chunk of a story. But as I read it, I want you to picture these events happening and notice the stark contrast between a powerful man brought low and a servant lifted high. We read, "Then Daniel returned to his house and explained the matter to his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. During the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. Then Daniel praised the God of heaven and said, 'Praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons. He deposes kings and raises others up. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness, and light dwells within him. I thank and praise you, God of my ancestors. You've given me wisdom and power. You've made known to me what we asked of you. You've made known to us the dream of the king.' And then Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to execute the wise men of Babylon, and said to him, 'Do not execute the wise men of Babylon. Take me to the king, and I will interpret his dream for him.' Arioch took Daniel to the king at once and said, 'I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can tell the king what his dream means.' And the king asked Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, 'Are you able to tell me what I saw in the dream and interpret it?' And Daniel replied, 'No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he's asked about. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He's shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in days to come. Your dream and the visions that passed through your mind as you were lying in bed are these. As your majesty was lying there, your mind turned to things to come. And the revealer of mysteries showed you what is going to happen. As for me, this mystery has been revealed to me, not because I have greater wisdom than anyone else alive, but so that your majesty might know the interpretation and that you might understand what went through your mind. Your majesty looked, and there before you stood a large statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, awesome in appearance. The head of the statue was made of pure gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of baked clay. While you were watching, a rock was cut out, but not by human hands. It struck the statue on the feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were all broken into pieces and became like chaff on a threshing floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace. But the rock that struck the statue became a huge mountain, and it filled the whole earth. This was the dream, and now we will interpret it to the king, your majesty. You are the king of kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands he's placed all mankind and the beasts of the field and the birds in the sky. Wherever they live, he's made you ruler over them all. You are that head of gold. After you, another kingdom will arise, inferior to yours. Next, a third kingdom, one of bronze, will rule over the whole earth. And finally, there'll be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, for iron breaks and smashes everything. And as iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all the others. Just as you saw that the feet and toes were partly of baked clay and partly of iron, so this will be a divided kingdom. Yet it will have some of the strength of iron in it. And even as you saw iron mixed with clay, as the toes were partly iron and partly clay, so this kingdom will be partly strong and partly brittle. And just as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay, so the people will be a mixture and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it itself will endure forever. This is the meaning of the vision of the rock cut out of the mountain, but not by human hands. A rock that broke the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold to pieces. The great God has shown the king what will take place in the future. The dream is true and its interpretation is trustworthy." Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell prostrate before Daniel and paid him honor and ordered that an offering and incense be presented to him. The king said to Daniel, "Surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery." Then the king placed Daniel in a high position and lavished many gifts on him. He made him ruler over the entire province of Babylon and placed him in charge of all its wise men. Moreover, at Daniel's request, the king appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego administrators over the province of Babylon, while Daniel himself remained at the royal court. This is an unreal story. This is an end-of-the-road type story. Daniel has to tell the king his dream or die. But see, Daniel knew what Nebuchadnezzar didn't know. That God Nebuchadnezzar thought he silenced, that God that Nebuchadnezzar thought he had written out of the history books when he took all the sacred items and he put them in his own temple, that God that Nebuchadnezzar thought didn't exist anymore, very much was alive. and hadn't been silenced at all. In fact, he was speaking loudly. He's the one that placed the dream in the mind of the king. And he's the one that gave Daniel the ability not just to identify the dream, but to interpret it. And he communicated something very powerfully to both men. I am in control. I am the one who is shaping the story. That's the big idea of Daniel 2, you guys. If you remember nothing else from this morning, my prayer is that you'll remember this. The next time you face a wall that feels impossible, the next time it feels like your life has hit a dead end and there is no way forward, remember that God is the one who is shaping the story. Proverbs 21:1 is a verse that's worth highlighting or circling in your Bible, especially if you've ever found yourself to be someone who gets nervous and frustrated and anxious about politics. It said, the king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he will. The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he will. Kings come and go. Leaders come and go. Presidents come and go. Political parties come and go. Nations come and go. But no matter how powerful they are or how powerful they think they are, their power is temporary. It's fleeting. It's going to pass. But God's power is forever. He's the one who's shaping the story. And Daniel knows that. And so he says, look, this is a situation that's kind of impossible. I'm not exactly sure what to do, but I know the author of the story, so I'm gonna take it to him. And it's a reminder for us that no matter how scary things feel, no matter how impossible life might be for you right now, no matter how worried you are about the rulers of this world and the problems that you're staring down, we know the final chapter. It ends in victory. It ends in all things set right and all things made new, because that's the way the author says it ends. There may be twists and turns along the way, but he's the one that's shaping the story. I think the major difference in this chapter between the mighty king who gets brought low and the lowly servant who gets lifted high is that Nebuchadnezzar rebelled against the idea that God was shaping the story, and Daniel built his life on it. And for you and me, we kind of have the same choice to make. We know that God is the one who's shaping the big story. We're caught up in this thing, and it's going somewhere. It's going in the direction God wants it to go. But we have some options in the middle of that. We have some decisions that we can make with our part in the story. And the question every single one of us has to answer is, whose glory are you chasing with your story? Whose glory are you chasing with your story? Nebuchadnezzar was chasing his own. See, here's the thing with this dream. For years and years and years, Christians have read it, and they've been like, well, which kingdom is which? Like, Daniel said, Babylon is the goal, but then where's America? Are we the bronze? Are we the iron and clay? Like, where are we then? We know when Jesus is coming back again. And first things first, this is all in the past. The gold was Babylon, the silver was Persia, the bronze is Greece, and the iron and clay is Rome. But I don't even think, like, which kingdom is which is the big idea of this vision. I think the interpretation of the dream is actually a whole lot simpler than that. And I'm pretty sure Nebuchadnezzar already knew it. That's why he's freaking out. He's trying to kill all the wise men in his entire country because he already knows what it means. He can't articulate it exactly, but he's pretty sure what's being communicated to him. So what we're going to find out next week is Nebuchadnezzar has had this lifelong dream of putting up a huge Statue of Liberty-sized monument to himself and making all the people of the world worship it. That's what he wants. And he's one of the 10 or 20 most powerful human beings that ever walked this planet, so he could pull it off. And he has this dream, and it tells him, yeah, man, you can pull that off. It's within your grasp and within your power to build this monument so that all the world will look at you standing above it in your glory and your power. You can do that, but your feet are made of clay. As glorious in gold as it looks at the top, man, you got no foundation. It's weak underneath because you're building it on you and you're nothing. You're going to die and fade away. Your empire is going to die and fade away. And if all it's built on is you and your glory and your power, there's nothing to it at all. It's going to crumble. And not even at the might of like some powerful army that marches in and overtakes it. Not even at the weight of a boulder hitting your statue, at a little stone, a little tiny rock, not made with human hands, not cut from human cloth. This rock is going to strike the statue and bring the whole thing crashing down. This rock is going to strike at the heart of that mighty empire of iron and clay. It's going to be this tiny rock that hits the Roman Empire. It seems like a small thing, but eventually it's going to capture the heart of the empire, and then it's going to grow, and it's going to grow, and it's going to grow, and all the kingdoms of the earth will fade away as this little kingdom that started as this little rock improbably striking at the heart of Rome will one day be a kingdom that's unshakable and forever, where all things are set right and all things are made new. Now, prophetically speaking, the little rock is the first mention that we hear of Jesus in the book of Daniel. The one who brought Rome to its knees. Pragmatically speaking, I can't help but read this and wonder how many of us are living just like Nebuchadnezzar. Just desperate for the world to look at us and see us as dazzling. Aiming our lives in the direction of our own glory, hoping that people will see us as beautiful or successful or wealthy or something else, building our lives on this worldly foundation, thinking that's where it's at. And if God has anything to say to us in Daniel 2, it's there's no foundation there. It's crumbling. It's nothing. It's gone. I'm shaping a bigger story. And what I want us to understand is that like we could keep doing that. We could keep doing that. We could get a whole lot of pats on the back from our world, building our lives on success and glory and beauty and wealth. But there's a better direction. There's the Daniel option, which is aiming our lives in the direction of God's glory, using our stories to build his kingdom instead. Daniel gets faced with this completely impossible situation, and instead of panicking, instead of having a woe is me moment, I've had like 800 of those in the last 10 months, like, oh, it's too hard. Daniel doesn't say that. He's like, well, I guess I should turn it over to God. And he does three simple things. Three things that you can do and I can do in the moments when it feels like we're stuck in the wilderness and life is impossible. Three steps toward aiming our story toward his glory. He surrounds, surrenders, and submits. Step one is to surround. The very first thing Daniel does after he gets told, we're cutting you to pieces, we're making your house a poop pile, is, oh man, I gotta find my people. And he goes and he finds his buddies, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He's like, all right, I'm gonna get the people of God together and we're gonna give this thing to God. Guys, we know God is in control, whether our heads and our necks are still hanging out tomorrow or whether they've been separated from one another. God's in control. I kind of like option one, so let's ask him to do something big. And they encourage each other and they pray. And that's actually step number two. It's surrender. He surrenders this whole situation to God. He says, well, this is impossible. You're the God of the possible. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to hand it off to you. Can you do something that's impossible? Not for my glory. Not so that the king and the nation will realize, oh, Daniel, he's the wisest of all the wise men. No, for your glory, so that this king who thought that he silenced you will know that you cannot be silenced. This king who thinks that he's shaping the story will understand he's water in your hands. You are the one who is shaping the story. Will you do that for me? And I love what Daniel does next. You know what he did right after he prayed that prayer? He went to bed. Seriously, this whole thing got revealed to Daniel in a dream. He got told, you're going to get cut to pieces. And he's like, God, that seems like your problem. I should get a nap in. And then the guy just fell asleep like any human facing certain death in the morning. Like, that's nuts. That's not normal. But it's a reminder that there is incredible peace to be found in turning over impossible things to the God of the possible. And the last thing Daniel did was he submitted. He submitted his life to worship. He said, look, if this whole thing happens, I'm going to get lifted pretty high, and Nebuchadnezzar's going to think I'm great, but this is not about my greatness, and this is not about my glory. I want to orient my heart in the right direction. And so he takes time in the middle of his difficulty to worship, to line his heart up in the right place and say, God, this whole thing is for your glory, because you're the author of the story. Here you go. And he builds God's kingdom with his life. And so surround, surrender, submit. That's what we can do when life feels impossible. That's the appropriate response to a world that sometimes haunts us and frustrates us and beats us up so much that we feel like there's no possible path forward. The appropriate response is to remember that God is the one who shapes the story and hand it off to him. And that doesn't mean life's always going to go the way that we want it to go. It certainly doesn't mean that life's always going to be easy. There will be moments when we feel like we are trapped in the wilderness and we're at the end of ourselves and we don't know what to do. There'll be moments that still feel impossible, but we need to remember nothing is impossible with God. Remember that pigeon I told you about that got shot in the head right after the 308th released it to try and save their lives? His name is Cher Ami. He's a French pigeon. But anyways, the French pigeon, Cher Ami, got shot in the head and it tore his left eye out, knocked him down. And then somehow he stood back up and took off flying again. And then a piece of shrapnel hit him in the chest and shattered his breastbone, and he continued flying. And then another piece of shrapnel ripped off his left leg so that the message he was carrying was hanging from torn ligaments, and he kept on flying, and he flew and he flew and he flew until he made it all the way home and delivered the message, and the artillery fire stopped, and the 308th Battalion was saved. Nothing is impossible. Nothing. Never, not as long as the author of the story is still writing. I know the chapter that we're in right now isn't the chapter that all of us want to be in. But the one thing I want us to remember as we leave is that the final chapter is all things made new and all things set right, because we know the one who's shaping the story, and that's how he says it ends. Will you pray with me? Heavenly Father, thank you. Thank you for not abandoning us to the difficulty and brokenness of this world that we live in. Lord, so many of us have struggled over the last year. So many of us are hurting right now in various ways. I just pray that you would thunder in our souls now so that we would learn all over again that you're the one who's shaping the story. And you'd help us aim our lives in the direction of your glory, not ours. Because we keep chasing the stuff the world says we need. We keep chasing our own glory. We're going to end up empty and crumbled. And we're going to waste away in the end. God, could you aim our lives in the direction of your glory as we face a world that sometimes feels impossible? Would you just remind us that you are the God of the possible, that you're the one who shapes the story, and that it ends in victory? We thank you for that. In Jesus' name, amen.